I'm Nadja Swart for BizNews.com, and to discuss the gut-brain connection, I'm joined by Professor Owen Epstein, who is a renowned and pioneering professor of gastroenterology based at the Royal Free Hospital in Hampstead, London. Professor Epstein, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, it's a pleasure, and it's great to have the opportunity to speak to you south of the equator. I'm actually a Wits graduate, so very pleased to be able to do this. I qualified in the early 1970s, spent my first formative years doing my housemanship in Johannesburg, and then came over to the UK to do my membership, which is the physician's exam, and got caught up in the system here, worked for Dame Sheila Sherlock, who's a very famous hepatologist, liver doctor, actually. Was appointed as a consultant after I'd done my research period, and all those years later, here I am to talk with you.
Much of your work refers to the function and importance of the vagus nerve. Now, this is something new to most people, and it's also gained prominence in the past decade. Why is this? And in layman's terms, can you explain what the function of the vagus nerve is?
Okay, I'll try and make it as easily digestible as possible. Start off by saying that there are 12 cranial nerves that emerge from the brain that subserve your eyes, your nose, your throat, tongue, ears, and the skin of your face. Now, one of them, called the vagus nerve, goes much further than that. It actually is called the vagus nerve because it's kind of the vagabond nerve. It travels all over the internal organs, and branches of the vagus nerve can be found on the heart, the lungs, and all the intra-abdominal organs. That means the liver, the gallbladder, the spleen, the kidney, and the digestive tract. And so the big question that arises is, why is this cranial nerve different from all other cranial nerves? And for generations, nobody's really asked that question with any depth. We're taught that the vagus nerve has certain functions. It makes your pupils constrict. It makes your stomach make more acid. It makes your gastrointestinal tract move a bit faster. But I mean, that's about all that medical students are ever taught about the vagus nerve. So to get back to your question, what's special about it? Number one, it's very long. It's the longest nerve in the body. And number two, what's it doing insinuating itself into all these organs? So the answer to that, or what appears to be the answer to that, is that in actual fact, the vagus nerve is the internet of the body. If I can be a little bit more expansive on that score, our body is constantly monitoring our state of safety. So we have our ears and our eyes and our touch, etc., that is constantly monitoring the outside world, much of it subconsciously. We're not consciously aware of everything that's happening in the environment, but there are millions of bits of information that are coming from the outside world and that tells us whether we're safe or not. Now, what about inside our body? Well, clearly, we need to know a little bit about our internal organs. And the vagus nerve acts as the eyes and ears and nose of the internal organs. So if you think of it, it is a conduit which uploads information from all the organs to the brain, not the conscious part of the brain, but the subconscious part of the brain, where it's interpreted, and then it sends messages downstream to provide the organ systems with an appropriate response. So there is what we call extraception, which is being aware of your outside environment, and there's interception. So the big question is, what role does the vagus nerve play in health, well-being, information systems? And I think the easiest way to think of it is as the information superhighway, or the internet of the body.
Psychosomatic orders relate to both psyche, mind, soma, body, are on the rise. Is this potentially explained by a disruption in the function of the vagus nerve?
Okay, so again, it's a critical question, and one which I think is very important to try and answer. If I can extend the analogy a little further, when we clinicians are faced with a patient who presents with a physical problem, so they might come as a gastroenterologist, they might come with indigestion, bloating, constipation, unpredictable bowel habits, feeling full half the time or not feeling hungry. These are the messages which a patient might bring to us. And what our Western medicine is so good at doing is it's extremely good at looking at the hardware. So if you think of the body and hardware, that's all about the organs. So the organs are things that you can see. So if you either dissect the body or you use CT, MRI, endoscopy, ultrasound, all these wonderful modalities that we have, we can actually see these organs like Superman looking with X-ray vision through somebody's body. And it's fantastic. Okay. The problem is that our machinery isn't just hardware. It's just the same as your smartphone or your computer isn't just hardware. There is software. And the software is the subtle bit you can't see. We're communicating here, looking at the hardware. But what's going on in the software, neither you nor I think really understand how on earth this is happening. So the body is not a system of individual organs. And I think one of the things that we Western medicine specialists have done is we've artificially divided the body up into systems, gastroenterology, neurology, nephrology, pulmonology, cardiology, gynecology. Now, this is completely man-made. It's a human paradigm. In fact, our machinery is all interconnected, just the same as a motor car engine. You know, you don't have a fan belt specialist and a carburetor specialist. The mechanic recognizes that, you know, each bit of the engine is actually impinging on another bit. So the body's the same. And what we've done is we've disconnected the organ systems by virtue of the way that we've organized medical care. And by doing so, we've actually inadvertently cut the connections. So getting back to the original analogy, when a patient comes to us, we're very good at the hardware. We haven't been very good at the software. In fact, we don't even think of it. We might say to the patient, look, we've seen the hardware, we've done all the scans on you, but we can't find anything. So you don't have anything life-threatening. And your problem is, you know, stress, problems that you had in childhood, all those things that we know that happen in life that are events that impinge on our well-being. And as a result of that, you know, you've got these symptoms. Now, that probably isn't the case.
Yes.
If I can take this a step further, all life forms, every life form you can think of, has one prime objective. And that objective is to survive and to reproduce. Mm-hmm. Now, to survive and reproduce, you firstly have to be aware of your environment. Obviously, that's part of the survival instinct. Mm-hmm. But to reproduce and to be creative, we need to feel safe. You can't indulge in relationships, in communication with other people, in eating, in enjoying play, if you feel that you're threatened. And the process of creativity and of reproduction of the species depends on you being safe. You can't do that stuff unless you're safe. So what the body is primarily concerned with is finding you a safe space, okay? So how does this all add up? Well, these sensory organs of the eyes, nose, ears, et cetera, and the internet of the body are constantly accepting information and informing us subconsciously of whether we're safe or not. And if we're safe, we have a sense of well-being, not necessarily happy going around with a big smile on our face and jumping for joy, but we feel content and comfortable. And that is the psychological expression of all this information being interpreted by the lower brain. Now, what happens if we're unsafe? Well, the first thing that happens is we run for safety, and you've heard of fight and flight. So the sympathetic nervous system, which is loaded, it's like a catapult, it's loaded, it's always ready to go, will, without you thinking, respond. So for example, if you drive your motor car and out the corner of your eye, somebody's inappropriately overtaking you, before you consciously think it through, your surveillance system will make you stop or move a bit faster. Or if there's a saber-toothed tiger that's lurking around the corner, and you hear a rustle behind a bush, your instincts will be to either, you know, face up to it or to flee. So there's fight or flight. So the idea of the first function of the vagus nerve as the internet of the system is that it has many functions. It's the internet, but in addition to that, it's what we call a brake. So if you imagine a catapult, which is our sympathetic nervous system, always ready. It has to be ready to react immediately. You can't wait. It's always ready. It's always ready to fire. What happens is that the vagus nerve sits on top of the sympathetic nervous system as a brake. It's saying, all is safe, you don't need to go. All is safe, you don't need to go. But if anything, either in the external environment or the internal environment, sends a message through our systems to say you're unsafe, what happens is that the vagus removes itself, the vagus brake disengages, and the catapult flies off. Okay? And the idea is that you resolve the problem. So from being unsafe, you respond by a very high energy activity, and then you recover, and the vagus brake comes back on. And by re-engaging, it gives you time to restore, to get that energy back, to allow your muscles to recover, allow your mind to recover, etc. So that's number one. So it's, the vagus is polyvagal. Poly meaning it's got many functions. Mm-hmm. Number one, it's providing all this information internally. Number two, it uses that information to keep the catapult under control. Okay. Number three, if it gets the message that there's a problem, it removes itself, allowing immediate expression of fight or flight. And then once you've resolved the issue, you come back. Now, there's a third part of the vagus nerve. Okay. The third part of the vagus nerve has been described by a guy called Stephen Porges. He's a developmental neurobiologist. He's interested in how the nervous system developed through evolution. And he's also interested in how the nervous system evolves from fetal life to adult life. And what he recognized was that reptiles, these are vertebrates, but they are cold-blooded animals. Because they're cold-blooded animals, their defense mechanism is quite different from our defense mechanism. So when threatened, so you take a frog, for example, an amphibious frog, when a frog is threatened, its instinctive response is to fake death. Mm. Okay, it's called thanatos. So its pulse rate slows down, its heart rate slows down, its muscles freeze, and it pretends that it's dead or a dead piece of meat. That is the reptilian defense mechanism. It doesn't have the sophisticated higher levels of defense. And what Porges has demonstrated is that in all mammals, but in human beings, we have this ancient reptilian response as well. So how is that important? Well, if your initial fight and flight doesn't work for you and you're still under threat, then what happens is the ancient vagus, which is normally dormant, starts to penetrate through. And it's kind of saying to the body, I've got this old method of dealing with things, and that is to kind of shut down and to pretend that you're not, you know, a nice piece of meat to eat, okay? When that happens, the pulse rate will slow, the digestion will slow down. You may faint, okay? Vasovagal fainting, you've probably heard of that. So it's an incredibly interesting and complex nerve. It's not just an ordinary nerve. It's the heart and soul of our survival to a certain extent.
What does it look like in a human? Is it comparable to perhaps a period of depression and numbness that allows us to survive through certain sorts of traumas? One must imagine that it looks entirely different for a human being.
Okay, so that's very perceptive. Obviously, these mechanisms are always interacting with each other, and they're not, except for the sympathetic nervous system, they're not either or. If you think of it as a ladder that you're going up and down on, at the bottom of the ladder is true thanatos, but up the ladder there is what's called the freeze reaction. And indeed, what Porges and I think many psychologists and psychotherapists and neurologists now believe is that perhaps our mental state, okay, the way that we feel, has got to do with us not resolving issues. In other words, those stresses in our lives that aren't resolved. And we then start to call on this freeze system, which can occur in different degrees. You can either feel unwell, slow down, fatigued, chronic fatigue. Okay. You might, your muscles start to feel weaker, fibromyalgia, or you might in fact withdraw completely. You might become very withdrawn and very uncommunicative, unable to sustain relationships. All the things that the good vagus does, called the ventral vagus, that the good vagus is helping you do that. The ancient vagus is saying, like, I'm bringing in these old survival things, and you may freeze. And in fact, a very interesting expression of that is in a situation where an individual is threatened by, say, rape. Why do they, you know, not respond to it in some way? You know, there's always the question that's asked. In fact, that's one of the situations where the only way out of the stress situation is to freeze. That's the body's reaction. It's not somebody thinking, oh, I'm just going to give up. You don't have control over this. This is very fundamental. So if you think of the vagus nerve as being this modulator of our safety overall and having different ways of trying to get us to a safe place, you can start to understand that people or individuals who are obviously or inadvertently under stressful situations that aren't being resolved, that their sympathetic nervous system starts to run out and they start to move into this area of what's called the dorsal vagus, which is where you start to get depressed, you start to feel frozen, cold, can't make communication, facial expression tends to disappear, you get abdominal symptoms because your bowel, which is under the control of the vagus nerve, is not acting properly, so there may be constipation, there may be diarrhea. You might find that, you know, you're getting strange loss of appetite. To sum it up, I would suggest to you that whereas the old idea was, I think, therefore I am, that's the old Descartes philosophy, I think and therefore I am, Porges's polyvagal idea is, I am, therefore I think. In other words, our cognitive, our ability to think and to feel is not something that we've got great control over. It's basically a secondary response to these more instinctive survival responses. I'd just like to take it one step further, because as organisms, I don't think that we are programmed to be particularly thoughtful. In other words, to be creative and thoughtful and interactive and to commune with other people, you need to feel safe, right? We're much more susceptible to, are we safe or are we not, slogans. So if you're a politician, for example, it's probably true in many democratic countries, each party will come out with a manifesto. You know, this is what we're going to do. Now, nobody's ever read a manifesto that I know of, okay? But if you come out with a slogan that says, make America great again, or get Brexit done, lock her up, it goes straight to your basic instincts, powerful instincts to say, well, if we lock her up, we'll be a bit safer. The vagus nerve is playing a very important role, not only in our sense of well-being generally, but in the way we as communities can respond. We're much more responsive to slogans, because that's the way we designed, than we are to deep philosophical argument. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you ask yourself the question, why do people, why do governments, why do organizations, why do businesses do what they do? Well, in advertising, they understand very well that it's the quick, slick picture or slogan that makes us feel better or makes us feel worse that is going to really drive our activity. And COVID is a great example of that, because if you remember, and I'm sure it's true in South Africa, certainly true in Europe, that when COVID became a big thing, everybody went and rushed off to buy toilet paper, okay? Why? COVID does not cause diarrhea. Why did everybody go and buy toilet paper? Well, it was FOMO. It was fear of missing out. Everybody else is going and getting toilet paper, and I'm going to go and get toilet paper. Why should I get toilet paper? Why not do something more sensible? I get, I don't know, tinned food or something, just in case I can't leave my home. Okay. So this is the vagus at work. I just want to give you a sense of how valuable it is to understand that we think we know what we're doing, but for most of the time, we're looking for safety.
To what extent do you think that human beings are still primed to activate the sympathetic state, which would have been valuable to our survival, but no longer serves us?
The answer to that, you know, it's hypothetical to a certain extent, but we evolved over tens of thousands of years, or probably millions of years, to deal with the jungle or the forest or the savanna. That's the way we evolved, okay? And within 10,000 years from the time of the agrarian revolution through to the industrial revolution, so over a very short time span in relation to evolution, we find ourselves living in this crazy world, which is an urban jungle. It's not the jungle that our senses were evolved to deal with. And in a sense, we haven't had enough time to evolve and adjust to the stresses and strains of the modern world and its workings, and in particular, the power of social media, for example, which is full of little bits of threatening information or information that is designed to make you feel better. It's happening all the time. So to answer your question in a way, I think that some of the disorders that we see in medical practice are, I think, fundamentally due to the fact that our evolution has really not allowed us to adjust to react to the stresses of the lives we live, which used to be go out and get some food. So get a community of hunters, let them go and hunt the food, okay? Bring it back home, make babies. So we'll keep you safe. We'll have soldiers around you to keep you safe. And it was very simple for tens of thousands of years. And if you go to the Kruger Park or to the Serengeti, that's the way the great animal kingdoms, you know, still live. We've gone much quicker than that. And I think it's probably led to a lot of our unexplained behaviors, our sense of ill health rather than well-being. I don't want to make it even more complicated, but just to say that there's now good evidence that this quick-acting vagus information system is very important in our immune system, so that if you are invaded by a bacteria or that something happens in your body, there's a mutation, the vagus nerve actually being electrical, because it all works on electrical signaling, will pick it up very quickly and will look for a response. And there's some evidence now that some of the autoimmune disorders, say Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis, to name three, there's some early evidence that if you stimulate the vagus nerve, you can actually return the immune system back to a much more balanced system, and there's improvement in the patient's condition. Now, this is very early work, but the vagus is, again, it's trying to keep you safe immunologically. And there is a view that people with COVID who land up on a ventilator, that their immune system is overactive. Okay, so that's the reason why a proportion of people in the early days, pre-vaccination, would land up very, very, very sick because of the immune system overreacting and causing damage to the body, your own immune system causing damage, particularly to the lungs. And again, there's some preliminary evidence that if you stimulate the vagus nerve, you can prevent that.
Then just to close off with, is the relationship between gastrointestinal gut health and mental health, is it circular?
Chicken or egg, really? That's the question you're asking. I don't know for sure. I mean, my own clinical experience, if as a gastroenterologist, you have the nerve to ask patients about their past history when they come with irritable bowel syndrome, where they feel down in the dumps and their bowels, they can never trust their bowels and they always feel bloated and they can't digest and they've got food intolerances and all that kind of thing. If you actually have the time and the opportunity to inquire of them whether they had any experiences in life, most of them will have had life experiences that may well have triggered this whole process. In other words, the first thing that happened was that there was a threat that was unresolved, and that resets the internet, the body's internet, in a way which wasn't providing you with high bandwidth. You had low bandwidth. The communication between your body was poor. My view, which may be wrong, is that the first thing that happens, it's not that an individual feels guilty and has poor communication with individual, you know, feels that they aren't worthy, and therefore their body reacts. I think it may be the other way around, that the body reacts to a life event, and then it doesn't work as well, and then it goes to the consciousness, which then says, I don't feel well, and I feel a bit depressed, and I feel a bit frozen. Mm-hmm. And then I think there is a vicious cycle that's established, okay? Because then again, you feel unsafe with yourself.
Yes.
You even feel unsafe about being in a safe place because you've been in a safe place before. And look what happened to you. You were suddenly caught in a war, post-traumatic mm-hmm. stress disorder, whatever. Even what you hope is a space, safe zone. So it is circular, but where the beginning of the circle is and where it ends, I don't know. My own view is that we as clinicians, mm-hmm. looking after patients with gut disorders, which aren't obviously hardware disorders, like mm-hmm. peptic ulcers and diverticulosis and Crohn's disease and colitis and cancer and so on and so forth. Most of the patients that we see in clinical practice have functional bowel disorders. They've got no hardware problem. And I usually say to patients, let's look at the hardware first and then we'll check the software. And they get it. They get it. In answer to your question, I'm of the belief, and it helps, I think, clinical practice, not to make people feel guilty about the way that they feel, but to relieve them of the guilt by saying, it's not your fault. It's the way that all bodies react to feeling unsafe. And that's what really triggers this whole bodily reaction. So put the guilt aside for a moment. It's not your fault. It's the design. You know, we're living in an urban jungle that may well be the cause of the way you feel. And, you know, patients respond to that. And you can measure the vagus. Like, you can get on a scale and know what your weight is. It's now possible to actually see what your vagus tone is like.
Please elaborate on this.
Let me think about this just for a moment to try and make it as simple as possible. If you remember, I said to you that the vagus nerve is able to put a brake on and take the brake off. Okay. That's one part of this very complex system. Mm-hmm. When you breathe in, the vagus nerve sends a message to say there's lots of oxygen in your lungs. And then there's a down message which says heartbeat a little bit faster mm-hmm. to get that oxygen to the body. When you breathe out, there's very little oxygen. And for efficiency, the vagus tells the brain that you've expired, or you've not expired totally, but you've breathed out, and that there's less oxygen, therefore go a bit slower. So between inspiration and respiration, between inspiring and expiring, your heart rate varies. Now, you can't feel it on the pulse. It's too subtle for that. It's microseconds. But there is a device called Bodyguard, which is a wearable device, which you wear under your clothing for 3 days. And in this little device is two things. Firstly, it's got an ECG, so it can measure in microseconds the difference in heartbeat between inspiration and expiration. And it's got something called an accelerometer in it, so it can feel the chest moving. So it knows when you're breathing in, when you're breathing out. It's very clever. And so what one does is, you know, you can do it by post. You send it to the patient and they apply it. They wear it under their clothing for 3 days and then they send it back. And then essentially using some artificial intelligence and all that new stuff, you can actually work out whether that vagus nerve is coming on and off appropriately. And what we often find is that the vagus break just isn't there. Okay, you've just got the sympathetic nervous system working the whole time. There's a loss of this, what's called heart rate variability. So, you know, it's possible now to get a measure of where you sit. I think that it's a very good measure, like getting on a scale, but the mm-hmm. same as when you look at somebody, you can say that they're overweight or not. You can also look at somebody and you can say, I think that they're in that sort of freezing mode, all right? Mm-hmm. Just by looking at their facial expression, their bodily reactions, their eye contact, et cetera. But it doesn't give you a number like a scale does. So this gives you a number, and patients are very responsive to that, to know exactly what your weight is. to know exactly what you're obtaining. So it is possible to measure, yeah.
Professor Epstein, thank you so much for your time. I'm Nadja Swart for BizNews.com.